Last week, we launched the James Webb Space Telescope. And by we, I mean humankind. Altogether, 29 states were a part of building it. Multiple nations supplied materials for it. Some of the parts were built in a red state and then tested in a blue state. Scientists from over a dozen countries worked on this project. So this telescope is truly universal. The news is full of stories about competition for resources, ethnic conflict, inequality of vaccines, greed for oil and territory. But people from all over the world seemed to sense that there was something transcendent here that called for putting aside nationalism in every form. James Webb isn't the property of one country or people. It belongs to all of us. After almost 30 years of work, it lifted off from a launch pad in South America. It launched on Christmas Day. Thousands of people from all over the globe watched in awe and wonder. Here at last was some good news, which we all needed very much. The amazing thing about this telescope is that it picks up a certain kind of light that we aren't able to see. Most light around us is unseen. It can't be perceived with the eye. The hope is that because of this, the James Webb Telescope will be able to see back farther than we've ever been able to see before, that it will take us back to what scientists call the infancy of the universe, the Big Bang. It should be able to examine galaxies that came into being very close to the dawn of time. So if it works, there's a chance that it may change our perspective on the entire cosmos by telling us about that miraculous moment when the universe was born. Matthew also tells a story about people from different nations and backgrounds coming together around a life-changing cosmic event, another miraculous birth. Magi from the East hear about the birth of the Christ child. They're astronomers, they're scientists. So they follow a star to find their way to where he is. Probably the Magi were followers of Eastern spiritual traditions. We also see that they put their trust in nature. They look to the earth and the sky for guidance on what to do and where to go. Just like many of us do here, we believe that faith and science are compatible. Lots of us have learned from traditions, Eastern traditions like Buddhism and Sufism, and our spiritual lives are richer for it. And we look to nature for wisdom. Have you ever had a crisis or a health problem or a grief? And it seemed that no matter what you tried, there was just no peace, no healing that you could find. Until something in you said, I have to take a walk by the water, or through the forest, or under the moon. And then consolation came, not from any human advice, but from creation itself. Well, here's a beautiful affirmation of that connected with the birth of Jesus. Faith and science and nature all work together, helping the Magi along their path. Initially, they're also following orders from Herod. He's the one who sends them towards Bethlehem to the Christ child. He sees Jesus, of course, as a threat to his power. Here's another king. So he hopes that the Magi will tell him where the child is so he can go and do him harm. But instead, something else happens. When the Magi arrive, when they find themselves in Jesus' presence, he changes their perspective on the entire cosmos. Here's the Prince of Peace, the Son of Humanity. And even though they practice a different faith, even though they're from the other side of the world, even though they speak another language, they know that this baby doesn't belong to one group or nation or culture or religion. This birth is a universal moment. It's good news for all humanity. One of our parishioners was once visiting a sick friend in the hospital when the on-call chaplain, a priest from the diocese, came in to offer the patient communion. And seeing the two of them, thinking they both might like to receive, he asked if our parishioner was Catholic too. Yes. So he took the pics out of his bag. He had the Eucharist already on his palm to offer. He started reaching out when offhandedly he thought to ask, "So what parish are you from?" You guys have many stories like this, I think. Spiritus Christi. And it was like this priest had been burned. That's how quickly he withdrew that hand back. And he gasped in horror. It was very theatrical. And he made this gesture over the Eucharist, like he had to shield Jesus from being contaminated by this person that he wasn't supposed to be in contact with. Many groups worry that Jesus has to be safeguarded, lest he fall into the hands of the wrong people, whoever the wrong people are in their minds. Usually it's about who doesn't have the right beliefs or doctrines or church membership status. But Jesus, of course, crossed all those boundaries all the time. He had a habit of always being friends with the wrong people, the ones thought to be outsiders by the establishment. He welcomed everybody, including people who were just curious, seeking, following a star or a hunch or a question. And we know this not just from the story of the Magi, but from the way he lived his whole life. He hung out with those who believed he was the Messiah, and with those who didn't. He chatted with the Samaritan woman and the Canaanite woman who practiced a different religion than his. He socialized with people who doubted and questioned, like many of the Pharisees did. He expressed his love for people who wavered in their faith, like the rich young man who just couldn't follow him quite yet. And the person who spoke that wonderful line in Mark's gospel, "Lord, I believe. Now help my unbelief." And he ate with everybody. Anytime Jesus could possibly throw a dinner party, he did. And anyone who was the least bit hungry was invited. Jesus belongs to everyone. He has from the beginning. Beginnings are funny things, though, aren't they? It can be hard to say when something truly began, like a calling. When does someone who is born to be a teacher become a teacher? Is it when she gets a teaching license? Is it when she writes her name on the board in her first classroom? Or is it when that person is 6 years old and some small voice within her says, "I am a teacher. That's who I am"? Or take an important friendship or a relationship. When does that begin? There's probably some occasion when you speak a commitment out loud, but that's not the beginning. There's when you first feel that spark of connection or recognition, but even that's not always the beginning. Some relationships have a transcendent quality. They are almost written in the stars. You feel deep down that you've always known each other. You've always been connected. Maybe some of you who have been married a long time feel this. I hope so. The poet Lee Young Lee begins a love poem for his wife of many years with these words. "I loved you before I was born. It doesn't make sense, I know. I saw your eyes before I had eyes to see. And I've lived longing for your look ever since." John's gospel speaks this way about Jesus. Matthew and Luke start with infancy narratives. Mark starts with an older Jesus being baptized in the Jordan. But John has Christ present from the birth of the universe itself. "In the beginning" are the first words in John's gospel. In the beginning, and the beginning of everything is what we're talking about here. In the beginning was the Word. This is what Richard Rohr calls the cosmic Christ, a universal presence that's been with humanity since the dawn of time. Christ loved us before Jesus was even born. Since before the Big Bang, Christ has been with us and within us, shining through nature and science and human beings, through everything that is. Clearly, it's hard to speak about this mystical presence using anything except poetry. And we heard some of that in the first reading from Isaiah. Poets and mystics often talk about the cosmic Christ using the metaphor of light. "Upon you the Lord shines. Isaiah says, arise, your light has come, you shall be radiant. Thomas Merton had a vision once. You've probably heard the story. He was walking through downtown Louisville, Kentucky, on his way to a routine appointment. Crowds of people, good and bad, of every faith and none, every occupation, every class, every culture, were pressing in all around him. And suddenly it seemed to him that they were all illuminated from within, lit by this light of likeness to God. And he knew that this is who humanity is all the time. We just don't see it. It's another of those many kinds of light that we can't ordinarily see, our own light, the light of Christ shining within us. Merton said, I was suddenly overwhelmed by the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I was theirs. It was like waking from a dream of separateness. If only everybody could realize this, but it can't be explained. There is no way of telling people they're walking around shining like the sun. In our cells, we have traces of the cosmos. The iron in our blood comes from stardust, from long ago dying stars. The water that makes up most of our bodies is two parts hydrogen, and some of that hydrogen may well go back to the Big Bang, the birth of the universe. And just as deep within us is the cosmic Christ, that unseen light, that radiance. That's our shared DNA that makes us all one. So why not turn more and more from that illusion of separateness that Merton talks about? Why not be like the Magi? The gospel tells us they disobey Herod. He tried to get them to betray Jesus, a person after their own heart. The opponents of liberation will always try to make enemies out of people who should be friends. Have you noticed that? They push that illusion of separateness, try to draw lines between, say, workers and environmentalists, racial justice advocates and LGBT justice advocates, migrant workers and poor white people, when the truth is, we're all such obvious natural allies, like Jesus and the Magi. But the Magi see through the plot. They refuse to throw Jesus under the bus. They foil the plan. As Matthew says, they go another way. At the height of apartheid, the white government of South Africa tried everything it could think of to discredit Desmond Tutu. Not an easy thing to do. At last, they came up with a plan. This was when Tutu was calling for international economic sanctions against South Africa as a way to hasten the end of apartheid. So they concocted a plot to make it look as if by calling for these kinds of sanctions, Tutu was the one harming poor black people while living the high life himself. So government operatives actually set out, rounded up a group of unemployed black South Africans, gave them pre-printed protest signs, and drove them to Tutu's house in the suburbs of Cape Town, knowing that when the cameras showed up, what they would see was this group, who they would assume had arrived voluntarily, demonstrating outside a very upscale mansion in a white suburb. In truth, this was where Tutu had to live. It was the official residence of the Archbishop. He was mandated to live there. But they would claim that these workers had lost their jobs because of the sanctions, and this would be just the photo op that they wanted. But Tutu got wind of this ahead of time, and he decided to beat them at their own game. He raced home, and when the not-really protesters got there, he greeted them very warmly and invited them right into his front garden. When the media got there, what they saw were protest signs discarded on the sidewalk, and a group of friends enjoying tea and cookies at an impromptu garden dinner party with Tutu as the host. He went around the plan of the oppressors and foiled it. He went another way. We don't have to accept the illusion of separateness. The best things in life call us to solidarity with each other and belong to everyone. Our greatest human achievements, tables like the one at that garden party and like this one, our altar table, where everyone's welcome and there are no wrong people. And of course, Christ, the one who loved us since before we were born, the one whose unseen light we walk in. All of us radiant, each human being shining like the sun.